The person in the school we'll look at today is the school of Madhva, or his other name. Madhva is kind of a title or a nickname almost that tradition gives to him. We'll see later why. Anandatirtha was his name, the name he received when he became a sannyasi, when he became a monk. Madhva is his dates are a little contested. I don't know if you're interested in dates. They're either 1197 to 1276, or according to others, 1238 to 1317. There's some disagreement on exactly when he lived, but it's roughly 13th, possibly early 14th century, but roughly the 13th century. And he was from right here, from Udupi in Karnataka. That's where still the center of his tradition is still located there. And so his tradition mainly spread here on the west coast. Ramanuja's tradition, we looked at yesterday, kind of spreads more on the east coast. And there's some overlap in their region, but it's fairly limited there. Unlike Ramanuja's tradition of Sri Vaishnavism, Madhva's tradition is actually a tradition that doesn't grow very exponentially. Ramanuja's tradition is a tradition that's really based in the Tamil country, but spreads to Andhra and even spread has some offshoots in the north that we'll look at later in this term. Madhva's tradition, on the other hand, is a very closed tradition in a sense. It is very difficult to become a Madhva, to become a follower of Madhva, if you're not born in a Madhva family. Sri Vaishnavas are much more open about these things. It doesn't matter what your background is. As long as you sort of share the teachings of Ramanuja, you can be considered a Sri Vaishnava. The Madhva are very restrictive in that. You have different sort of trends in it, but in general, that's their mood. They're also much more restrictive in terms of who they allow to access their primary texts. They have a hierarchy of texts, and they say there are certain texts that anyone can read. From within their tradition. Some of those are Madhva's works, some of those are works of other authors in the tradition. Then they have certain texts that they allow persons who are initiated in the tradition to read. And then there are certain texts that they only allow more mature persons that are initiated into the tradition to read. And so they have a hierarchy of texts. And as an outsider, you don't have access to all their literature, basically. But despite the fact that they're sort of a relatively small school, Madhva is a very influential thinker and a very prominent teacher. In the south of India, they often talk about the three sampradayas, the three schools of Vedanta, which is Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva. And that's how they look at things. We'll see later in the north, they look at things very differently. But in the south, that's how they see it. And so Madhva is seen as one of the pillars of Indian thought. He's one of the main schools of Vedanta. And he's particularly influential in that he launches a very systematic attack on Shankara's school. Shankara lived a couple of centuries earlier. And Madhva, as we'll see, his theology is the radical opposite of Shankara's theology. And Madhva launches a very vigorous attack that is perpetuated by his followers throughout the second millennium. And a lot of the literature that is produced by the tradition is really literature that is addressing the writings of Shankara's school. And then, of course, the followers of Shankara launch a counterattack. And so they write a lot of works against Madhva school, and then the Madhva school writes a lot of works against those works that are directed against them. And so you get this vast library that develops in Sanskrit of this very polemical literature. Madhva school is, we've seen yesterday, last week, a little bit of the nature of Vedanta, where Vedanta, it's a theological school, that derives its theology from the interpretation of the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita as codified or explained in the Brahma Sutras. And so for Vedanta, the primary source of knowledge of Brahman, of the self, of the world, is all based on scripture. And so it's about correct interpretation. Madhva's tradition brings in something else into the equation, and that is their attack against Shankara's school is twofold. On the one hand, they say, you don't give an adequate, a good interpretation of the Upanishads. Your interpretation of it doesn't make sense. It doesn't take into account all the statements there. And the second level of attack they have is, even if it were a correct interpretation, and taking into account everything that's sort of stated in the Upanishad, it's a bad theology. It doesn't make any sense. It goes against logic. And so they invest a lot of energy into development of logic and philosophy of language. And so that's the sort of their two-fold attack on Shankara's tradition. Madhva is also very interesting and worthy of looking at, I think, because he has a lot of ideas that you don't find in any other Hindu theologian or even any other Indian thinker of the classical period. We'll see that there's a number of ideas that he has that you'll probably find a little odd, I'll try to explain his reasoning and his sources and where he's drawing from in coming to those conclusions. Now, I didn't want to project it, so I have you. This is a standard iconography sort of image of Madhva that is perpetuated in their tradition. And you see the bottom figure that is sitting there, cross-legged, that is Madhva himself. But the reason I show you this picture is because the iconography is very revealing. There's a lot that is said about Madhva's theology in that simple image. First of all, you see Madhva is kind of sitting there, and he's kind of a big person. He's a sort of a strong body. Tradition likes to, whenever his followers talk about Madhva, whenever they write about him and sort of praise him for it, they often mention the fact that he was physically very strong and that he had an enormous appetite as well, and you see him sitting there, and he's holding a palm leaf manuscript in one hand, so he's obviously teaching from the text, and in his other hand he holds like this, and he has two fingers up. And this is, whenever you see a picture of Madhva, he will always be seated like this, and he would always hold up two fingers, because this is his theological conclusion. This is his Siddhanta. It's Dvaita. It's a dualism. Which is very different from both Shankara and Ramanuja. Shankara, of course, his theological conclusion is Advaita. It is a non-dualism. And we've seen Ramanuja says it's actually a non-dualism as well, but there is it's Vishishta, it's qualified, or there's a variety within that non-dualism. Madhva says, no, it is a dualism, and he will always be depicted like this. And this is something he stresses again and again and again and again. This is the foundation of his theology. It's the difference. We'll come back to that in a moment. But then you see above Madhva, there's these two other figures that appear there. I suppose you know the top one. Who's that? Yes, that's Hanuman. Hanuman is the monkey who appears in the Ramayana, and he's the servant of Ram and assists Ram in finding Sita and defeating Ravana. The person below that, the middle person, can you guess who that is?
I thought it might be
Vayu.
Krishna?
Sorry? I thought it might be Vayu, but then I could be wrong. I don't think it is.
Well, you're getting in the right direction. The second figure is Bhima from the Mahabharata. And he's one of the five Pandavas, one of the five brothers who are fighting against their cousins for the throne. And they're, of course, assisted by Krishna. And Arjuna is one of the five brothers. He's one of these, the one of the conversation partners in the Bhagavad Gita. And this is how Madhva himself actually identifies him. Yeah. You have this handout there. You have the first passage there. This is from the Vishnu Tattva Nirnaya, which is a work Madhva himself wrote. And it's a verse he has at the beginning. It's a verse that, with some variation, appears in some of his other works as well. And he says, Vayu, whose three divine forms are spoken of in the Veda, whose nature is knowledge and ability, who supports the actions of the entire world, who worships the Lord, and who manifests in his full splendor, first carries Rama's message, had a mighty body in his second manifestation, and as Madhva, the third form, composed his book as an offering to Keshava. And so what Madhva is saying is that Hanuman is, it depends on who you talk to, of course, which tradition you talk to. Hanuman is often said either to be an avatar, a manifestation of Vayu, or as being the son of Vayu, and Bhima is said to be the same. And so the Madhva tradition and Madhva himself says that Vayu manifests as Hanuman, Vayu manifests when Rama appears, Vayu manifests as Bhima when Krishna appears, and Vayu manifests in the third form as Madhva himself. And of course, this is not something that is terribly unique in Indian thought. You have a lot of people that are seen as avatars of particular deities or of particular personalities. But for Madhva, this is not just one of the unique things is that he himself is saying this. Often what you find is you have these figures that are seen as avatars, and it's kind of the later tradition looks back and then says, well, he's an avatar of Shiva, or he's an avatar of such and such person. Madhva himself, in several of his works, claims this. And for him, this is not a light claim, because, as we'll see, Vayu is central to his theology. Vayu is the god of wind. But for Madhva, Vayu is more than just sort of a deity that governs the movement of air in this world. For Madhva, as he says actually in this verse, he says, Vayu who supports the actions of the entire world. This is a central idea in Madhva theology, that Vayu manifests within every body and within every living being as prana, as the life air. And it's prana that moves the body. It's prana allows the body to act. And so he supports the actions of the entire world. He gives, he allows things to happen. But then he worships the Lord. And this is very crucial for Madhva's theology. Vayu is a servant of God. He does not only just cause everything to happen, all our movements. If I move my arm, this is because in the Indian system, it's because the prana, the airs that are in my body, are allowing moving my arm. And so they say, well, this is Vayu who's moving my arm in a way. But Vayu is a devotee of God. And so what Vayu is doing, he's offering all the actions of the entire world to God. And so for him, everything he does is an act of worship, is an act of devotion to God. And so everything is worship to God. Now, Vayu has more significance than that even in Madhva's system. As we'll see, you kind of get this a little bit from this picture. There's sort of an upwards movement in sort of the dynamic of the image. Madhva is very fond of hierarchies, as we'll see in a moment. He likes to put everything in a hierarchy and create hierarchies of practically anything that you can conceive of. And so the whole world is structured in a hierarchy as well. And so you have, the demons and the ghosts sort of at the bottom, and then you have the human beings, and then you have the gods above that. And then at the very, very top, you have God himself, the creator of the world and so on. But just below God, there is Vayu. And there's a phrase that they often use in the Madhva tradition, and that is that Krishna, Madhva is actually really focused on Krishna rather than on Vishnu as Ramanuja is, but we'll come back to that. Krishna, they say, is Purushottama. He is the supreme Purusha, the supreme being. And they say Vayu is Jivottama. Vayu is the supreme Jiva, is the supreme living being. For Madhva argues that Vayu is you know, not only can we not do anything in this world without the grace of Vayu, but even to obtain liberation, we need the grace of Vayu. It's only by the grace of Vayu that we can obtain liberation. When we die and we're sort of eligible for liberation, it is Vayu who transports us to God, who sort of brings us to God. And so Vayu is central to his theology. And here you have Madhva who's saying, I am that person, which means he's saying, I'm the one who's giving liberation. I'm the one who's moving everything in this world. I'm the supreme living being in this universe. It's a very bold claim that he's making. And I mean, basically what he's saying is, to put it in Christian terms, no one comes through the Father, goes to the Father, but through me. That's kind of what he's saying. I'm the one who gives liberation, so the only way you can obtain liberation is through me, I am Vayu.
Who says that?
Madhva.
Madhva.
Because he identifies with Vayu. And of course, you have this next passage there, which we won't read through, but this is a passage from the Rig Veda, which if you pick up any translation of the Rig Veda or of this hymn, you'll read it as a hymn to Agni. Madhva himself makes reference to this hymn in several places of his writings, and he argues that this hymn is actually not about Agni, it's not a hymn of praise to Agni, but it is talking about the three manifestations of Vayu. Now his reading is very, creative. if you see his reasoning, his explanation of particular words, you might sort of scratch your head a little bit and say, well, this might be a little bit of a stretch. He talks about Madhva who... and the reason he likes this passage is because this word occurs in it. The word Madhva occurs in this hymn. And so he sees that as sort of, at least that's how he looked at it, and that sort of proof of his existence. If you can read later, but you can see it's again the same idea. Vayu appears as Hanuman when Rama appears, Vayu appears as Bhima when Krishna appears, and Vayu finally appears as Madhva. Now, Vayu, as it says in that verse that Madhva gives at the beginning of this Vishnu Tattva Nirnaya, which literally means an exposition or an inquiry into the truth of Vishnu, he says there that Vayu is a servant or is worshipping God. And this is very important for them because they say whenever God appears, Vayu will appear as well. Vayu will never appear when God does not appear. And so they say, God appears as Rama, Vayu appears as Hanuman, and Hanuman is there to assist Rama in accomplishing what he needs to accomplish. And so he helps to fight against Ravana, he helps to find back Sita, he's the one who, as he says in the verse, he's the one who brings the message of Rama to Sita, who finds Sita and then helps to defeat Ravana. When Krishna appears, then Vayu appears as Bhima, and he helps to defeat the Kauravas, he helps to, he fights Duryodhana and so on. He's a fierce warrior, he's a very strong person. And so finally, Vayu appears as Madhva. And of course, the question then that one might ask then is, well, where's God then? The way the Madhva tradition looks at it says, well, the third avatar of God that appears when Madhva appears is Vyasa. The Veda Vyasa, the divider, literally the divider of the Veda, the person who writes the Mahabharata, who tradition accredits with the writing of the Puranas and so on. He says that the Madhva tradition sees him as an avatar of Krishna, and they say he appeared and Madhva appears in order to help this particular form of God in his mission. And of course, Vyasa's mission is to propagate the teachings of the Vedas, to propagate the correct understanding of reality. And so that's how they see Madhva in relation to that. Of course, tradition says Vyasa lived a long time before Madhva appears. And Madhva is 13th century. Vyasa, tradition says, lived 3000 BC or something at the beginning of Kali Yuga. But the Madhva tradition says, well, actually, Vyasa is still alive even today, and he lives in Badrikashram in the Himalayas. And it's sort of only, but he only manifests to those who are qualified. And the story goes that Madhva, he was born in the south, he becomes a sannyasi, he becomes a monk at the age of 12, and he then starts traveling around India, and finally he reaches Badrikashram, and there meets Vyasa, is initiated by Vyasa, and Vyasa then gives him the task, this is how tradition sees it, Vyasa gives him the task that now you should go and spread these teachings and remove the heretical views and sort of the wrong conceptions, you should demolish them. And so the way tradition looks at Madhva is he is fighting for God like Hanuman and Bhima is, but he's fighting intellectually. And so he's assisting God in his mission of you know, reestablishing the real teachings of the Veda. So you find some of these things. I mean, Madhva himself in his writing claims he has met Vyasa. He claims himself he is Vayu. But of course, the stories are developed further in hagiographies of Madhva, which are written by the oldest we have was written by the son of one of his most intimate disciples. And so it's very early on after his passing away, you have these texts that are produced about him, sort of that place his life and his activities in this whole mythological framework. Now, of course, there's one important aspect about this is that Hanuman and Bhima, they're fighting against the bad guys, they're fighting against the demons or against the those that have, you know, sort of. Yeah, against the demons. So who is Madhva fighting against? Tradition, in some of the Madhva hagiographies, they're very interesting because they give a whole history of Indian thought up until that point, but couch it in this whole mythological language. And so what they say is that one of the demons that Hanuman and Bhima were fighting, he was reborn closer to Madhva's time. And guess who that demon is? Shankara. So Shankara is they see Shankara as a demon who was reborn in the south in the 9th century, and Madhva's task is to defeat this particular demon. Madhva is so he's assisting Vyasa in his mission, and the way he's going to do that is by writing a lot of books. And Madhva is a very prolific author. He writes commentaries on the main Vedantic texts. So he writes commentaries on the Vedanta, on the Brahma Sutra, on the Bhagavad Gita, and on the Upanishads. Remember, Ramanuja did not write commentaries on the Upanishads, but Madhva does. And he's not content to write one commentary on the Brahma Sutras, but he sort of writes three. And he's not content to write one commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, but he writes two. And so you see, with those three types of commentaries, he's engaging very much with Vedanta. He's sort of a traditional Vedantin, like Shankara and like Ramanuja. We saw Ramanuja brings in the Vishnu Purana as an important text. Madhva will bring in two other texts that are very important to him. One is the Mahabharata, which is, of course, tradition says is authored by Vyasa, and the other one is another Purana, not the Vishnu Purana, but the Bhagavata Purana, and he writes commentaries on these texts as well. They're very lengthy, of course, so they're substantial works that he writes on these. And if that's not enough, he decides to write a commentary on part of the Rig Veda as well, which is fairly unusual because not a lot of people want to engage much with the Rig Veda, but he decides, I'm going to write a commentary on the Rig Veda. And his whole point in that commentary is to prove that the Rig Veda is not a polytheistic text as most people understand it, but is actually teaching a monotheism, and that all the names in the text are references to God. So he says, when you know, Indra is one of the chief deities in the Rig Veda, but Indra literally means chief or a leader. And so he argues, well, who fulfills the true meaning of that word, Indra. He says that is God, that is not the God with a small g, the Deva Indra, but it is God on whom everything depends for its existence. He's the true leader. So therefore Indra primarily refers to God and secondarily refers to the deity Indra. And so that's what he does in his commentary there, which is very interesting. But again, his reading is very creative and apart from that, he writes a number of other sort of independent works that are not commentaries. The most important one of those is the one where that first verse is from the Vishnu Tattva Nirnaya, an exposition of the truth of Vishnu, where he kind of gives an overview of his theology. Now, Madhva writes a lot and comments on these lengthy texts. His style of writing is unlike, Ramanuja is very verbose. I mean, he likes to use a lot of words to explain his teachings. Madhva is the opposite. He's very concise. He often doesn't argue for his views very much or for his interpretations, but he just kind of states them. He says, this word means that, and end of discussion. And that's the sort of how he works. And on top of that, what he does is he quotes a lot of other texts. If he can let another text make the point that he wants to make, he'll do it. And so Madhva's works, is particularly his commentary on the Upanishads, is basically sort of an anthology of a whole bunch of other texts, which are often surprisingly, the verses he quotes are often surprisingly similar to the verses he's commenting on. And so they just kind of add something to it. So the verse says, God is such and such thing, and then the verse says God is such and such thing, the identical thing, and then sort of adds a few other thoughts to it. And that's how he works. He just sort of says, okay, here's my commentary on this verses. The such and such Purana says this. There you have it. Let's move on. And that's his style of writing. Now, if you remember, Ramanuja is very conservative, or very he doesn't sort of like to quote a lot of texts. Madhva does. B.N.K. Sharma, who's I think he's still alive, and he's like really, really old, but he's like the scholar on the Madhva tradition. He made a list in one of his books of all the works that Madhva cites, and it's a list of 292 books. And then in a footnote he says, what is not included in this list are all the citations from well-known Vedic, Upanishadic, Puranic, epic, and other texts. So those 292 texts are texts that you probably, if I were to read out the list, you'd never have heard of them, but most people have never heard of them before. They're texts often that the only texts that we don't know of, that we don't have, and the only citations that we have of those texts are in Madhva's writings. Which led Shaivas later on to the conclusion that Madhva made them up. And so the tradition, in Shaivism in the 16th, 17th century, you get this criticism against Madhva's tradition by basically saying, well, you're the founder of your tradition basically made up all these texts, so they're not authoritative for us and we're not going to engage with these. The Madhvas, of course, don't agree with that. And they have very elaborate defenses on why these texts are not fabricated. Gave you a bibliography at the end of the handout. There's a book on there. Mesquita, the third one, a German book, which looks at Madhva's untraceable sources. It's quite a thick book. It's kind of interesting. This is part of the controversy surrounding Madhva, is that he quotes all these texts that nobody knows, nobody has ever heard of before, and did he make them up or not? Who knows? I mean, it's of course we know authors quoting texts that we don't know, and we know the text got lost, but generally those texts are also quoted by other authors. Now there's about 150 works or something like that, if I remember correctly, that you don't find in any other author, that only Madhva cites. That's part of his thing. But one group of texts that is very important for him, acquire is a corpus of text called the Pancharatra. I don't know if Gavin has said anything about this. Gavin really likes Pancharatra, so he tends to talk about them. But the Pancharatra are tantric texts. They're the texts that the Vaishnava traditions, like Madhva and like Ramanuja's tradition, use for their all their ritual practice is derived from the Pancharatra text. They're tantric texts, which means they're not seen as part of the Vedic revelation. And so that they have their own sort of category, and the tradition sees them as being revealed directly by the deity that these texts venerate, which in this case is Vishnu. And they're very rich in ritual and in meditation and sort of using mantras and stuff like that, and visualization and so on. But they're also very rich in theology. The Vaishnavas argue that these Vaishnava tantric texts, these Pancharatras, as they're called, are on an equal level as the Vedic revelation, and that they're not in contradiction with what the Vedic revelation is saying. And Yamuna, Ramanuja's guru, who passed away, if you remember the three fingers story, you know, passed away before Ramanuja met him, he actually wrote a whole book called Agama Pramanya, The Authority of the Pancharatra text, where he argues that these texts should be seen on an equal level as the Vedic revelation. And next week we'll look at Shaivism and we'll see there's a very different understanding there of tantric revelation.
What these texts contain, what they describe?
They talk about it's sort of a part theology, part ritual practice. Uh-huh. So it's a lot of talks basically, you know, all the temple worship and so on, you know, the consecration of images and temples, and that's all coming from Pancharatra for the Vaishnavas. For the Shaivas, it will come from Shaiva tantric text. Those types of things are in there. Meditations on you know, how to meditate on certain mantras and how to visualize certain things and so on. But what Madhva is primarily interested in when it comes to Pancharatra is their theology. He quotes them profusely in his commentaries, which means he comes up with it's kind of, if you take Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva in their interpretation of certain Upanishads, it's kind of Shankara is here and says, you know, this is what this text means, and Ramanuja comes along and says, yeah, this is kind of what this text means, but not quite. But you know, sort of, they're more or less in agreement. Madhva is here, and he'll say, you know, to give one example, you know, in the Taittiriya Upanishad, there's a talk of five levels of consciousness or five levels of being, and it starts with food, and then prana, life, air, and then goes to mind, and then intellect or perception or the self, and then finally bliss, and these are the five levels of existence, and it's basically Ramanuja and Shankara both agree that they're just different levels of understanding. So the people whose consciousness is not very developed, they just think in terms of food. Those who are a little more advanced, they think in terms of life force, and finally, you know, the ones that are qualified for liberation, they think in terms of bliss. Madhva comes along and he says, well, actually this passage is talking about five different forms of Vishnu, and it's not about the self, and he brings in some Pancharatra text that talks about five different forms of Vishnu, and that's kind of it. And so Ramanuja and Shankara are kind of in agreement, and their disagreement is whether there's individuality or not and things like that. But then Madhva comes on with something entirely different, and you kind of, you know, if you don't belong to Madhva's tradition, you kind of go like, huh? Where does this come from? But the thing is, Madhva is very consistent in this. And it's kind of initially, I liked reading Madhva's commentary on the Upanishads because they're so interesting. And initially, I was always thinking, you know, this is really weird. What's this guy doing? But the more you read him, the more you kind of see, well, it is weird, but there's a system, you know, he's consistent in it. And so, you know, it's sort of hard to find fault with it because of that, because he's so consistent with it, and it's kind of like, well, why not read it like that in a way? And so, yeah, that's sort of how he does things.
So, but why did he evaluate Chaturanga so highly?
Well, it's all the Vaishnava traditions. So Ramanuja does as well. But yeah, he just likes their.
And how about the modern view? How do modern scholars think about Panchatra? Because Madhva said it could be qualified as equal as Veda, right?
Yeah.
But how about modern view?
Well, it's, most scholars see it as sort of a separate thing, yeah, as a later corpus of text that arises in the first millennium AD. I mean, it's something that in Vedanta, everyone will bring in Pancharatra, except Shankara. Shankara doesn't like these texts, and so he doesn't engage with these texts, and argues that these texts are not don't have any authority, and they're just texts that some guys made up. Whereas all the other schools of Vedanta will say that no, Pancharatra is authoritative, can be brought into this equation. The way Ramanuja does it is more or less saying that, okay, here's Vedanta, here's my commentary on the Upanishads, but then here's how we live, and the way we're going to live, the way we're going to practice is based on Pancharatra with the understanding of the Upanishads. Madhva kind of says, here's the Upanishads, and we're going to understand the Upanishads through Pancharatra. That's sort of his approach. You see Madhva's fingers are holding, he holds them up, and so he's a dualist. He's a dualist not in the sense that he believes there's only two things, or that there's a dualism of mind and body or something like that. He actually says there's three things. He says there's God, there's the world, and there's the living beings, the jiva. And they're all distinct. So we have God, jiva, which is a living being, and matter. For him, difference is the essential idea in his theology. And I gave you a passage there on the second page, at the bottom of the second page of the handout, where he argues this. And you'll see there's some important ideas that come through there. He says, difference is of the nature of things. It cannot be argued that difference cannot be viewed as the nature of things, as it is apprehended only relatively to the perception of a given object and that from which it differs. In most cases, the nature of things is revealed in perception as being different from all else. If difference were not the nature of things, then when an object is perceived, its distinction from all else would not be known. If that were the case, the perceiver himself might doubt whether he is his own self or the pot he perceives. No one falls into such error or doubt. So he's saying difference is everything that we perceive, we understand to be different from something else. And this is the essential nature of perception, of cognition, that we understand that I see that chair, and I see the chair, and I know this chair is different from myself, this chair is different from the table that's in the room, this chair is different from you, and so on. And so difference is the essential characteristic of cognition. He says if that weren't the case, if difference weren't so ingrained in everything, or not so essential to perception, I might think that I am the chair, or as the example he uses, I am the pot that I perceive, because I would just see oneness and I'd be in doubt, am I really me, or am I this pot? And that would be a lunatic would think like that. And so he says, this is not a very good idea. And so, but what he assumes is of course a realism, that the world and perception leads to correct knowledge, leads to a real it's a valid means of acquiring knowledge. But he develops this idea of difference to everything, and he says that there's five main differences that we need to understand. And at the moment, we're in bondage, we're bound by our activities, we're suffering in this world because we do not realize the difference. Shankara, of course, he says, we're suffering because we do not realize the oneness of everything, that Brahman only exists. Madhva kind of turns it upside down and says, no, we suffer because we don't realize the difference. And he says, there's five differences. The first is there's a difference between God and us. They're not the same. We are not God, and God is not us. There's a difference between God and matter. The world is not God, and God is not the world. Now, this is very this particular part is very unique for Vedanta. The cornerstone of every other school of Vedanta is that God is not just the efficient cause of the world. God does not just create the world, but he creates the world out of himself. He's the material cause of the world. Ramanuja says, no, God is not the material cause of the world. The world is something separate, and God just uses the world, which the matter, which is pre-existing, to create the world. But he does not create matter out of himself. It's sort of a separate category that exists eternally. And then the third difference is matter is different from the living entities, and the living entities are different from matter. And then you have two more differences, which is one form of matter is different from another form of matter, and one living entity is different from another living entity. So they're not the same. And so you end up with five differences. He says the reason we're suffering, the reason we're bound by our work, is because either we think we are God, we think we're another living being, we want to be like another living being, we think we're this body, we think we're matter, and so on. And so we have to realize that these differences are essential. They're the nature of reality. But of course, the problem is the Upanishads talk about the jiva, or the self, the living entity, having qualities that are like the qualities of Brahman, of God. So how do you deal with that? How does Madhva deal with that? He says, well, that we can understand not with the metaphor of the body and the soul, which Ramanuja used, whereas the soul, the self, is God, and the body that is controlled by God and that is dependent on the self for its existence is like the living entities and the world. Ramanuja says, no, that's a bad analogy, it doesn't work. The better analogy is an object and its reflection. And this is what he uses. He says, the self is a reflection of God, meaning that it has similar qualities like God, but it is different because a reflection is not, you know, the analogy he uses often is you put pots of water outside and the sun shines and the sun is reflected in each of the pots. And he says the reflections are not the sun. They're different from the sun, and yet they have similar qualities like the sun, because I can look in there and I can see sort of a round object that's sort of luminous. The water reflects the light of the sun, and so on. And so there's a difference there, but the most important thing for Madhva is that the reflection is dependent on the object. If the object were not there, the reflection would not exist. And so he says that God is not just, Brahman is not just one other category, but it is the thing that exists, and everything else is dependent on him. And I gave you at the end of the handout, you have this this chart there, which I just give you for purely illustrative purposes, just to understand how complex Madhva's classification is and how he likes to put everything in neat boxes and so on. There's actually a lot more, but it didn't fit on the page. You have here, sort of in the middle, on the right side, it says unevolved matter and evolved world. Under unevolved matter, there should have been 26 more subheadings, but they didn't fit on there, so I left them out. But anyway, but the important thing is that just at the top, you see, it says reality, tattva, sort of the things that exist. It says there's two types. There's independent, swatantra, and dependent, aswatantra. And the independent one is Vishnu, is Brahman. He's the only being that is fully independent, that is not governed or not dependent on anything else. Everything else that you have there, if you look at dependent, you have, ignore the non-existing. But then you have, under existing, you have the insentient and the sentient. The sentient are the living beings, or the jivas, and the insentient is matter. They're all dependent on Brahman for their existence. So they're different from them, from him, but they depend on him for their existence. That's his argument. Now... Yeah, of course, it's sort of saying that God is not the material cause of the world, and that matter is just something that exists eternally, that God just uses, you know, sort of uses the Lego blocks or something to create something nice out of it, allows him to escape a big problem that Vedanta has to deal with, and that is that if God creates the world out of himself, and the matter is by nature changeable, that means there's change in God. And so this is a problem that all Vedantists have to deal with. He says, well, I don't have that problem because God doesn't create matter out of himself. Matter is different from him, so that's that. It also allows him to kind of circumvent the problem of evil. Because his point is that when it comes to the problem of evil, why is there suffering in this world? If God is sort of the creator of everything, he says, well, God is not the creator of everything, because the living entities and matter already existed before him, and he kind of just, oh, not before him, but they sort of, all three exist eternally, and he kind of just uses them to do things with them. And so the suffering that is there, the evil that is there in this world, is just residing in the living beings and in matter and not in God. So that's kind of how he gets away with that. But then, of course, we're stuck in matter, and we have to obtain liberation, which means we have to obtain Brahman. How do we do that? He says, like Ramanuja says, the path is bhakti. The path is a path of devotion. But for Madhva, devotion and knowledge, bhakti and jnana, are not separate things. He says, devotion is fully Ramanuja actually said something similar. Ramanuja said that knowledge is upasana, knowledge is worship. If you know God, you worship God. And so there's no... And Madhva is something similar. He says, in order to have bhakti... Actually, you have this nice quote that I gave you on the second page, at the very, just above on difference. Actually, the one about that. The firm and unshakable love of God, which rises above all other ties of love and affection, based upon an adequate knowledge and conviction of His great majesty, is called bhakti. That is devotion. That's His definition of bhakti. The important point for our discussion here is that it's based upon an adequate knowledge and conviction of His great majesty, of God's great majesty. He says, what bhakti leads you to understand the nature of God, and to worship God, meaning you understand you're dependent on God. So in order for bhakti to really arise, you need knowledge of reality, of all these differences. And so he explains that in but it's kind of, for him, it's not that knowledge leads to bhakti, and or bhakti leads to knowledge. It's kind of all woven into each other. And yeah, that in the next verse that he quotes there, that word that I quote there. By devotion, one attains knowledge, he says. Devotion is the primary qualification. You have to have sort of realize your dependence on God, and sort of have this outpouring of affection for God, and then knowledge arises. And from knowledge comes greater devotion, and from that greater devotion, a vision of God. And by that vision of God, a very great devotion to God. And so it's kind of, your devotion increases along the way. And he says, then one attains liberation, and by that one attains devotion again, which is the essence of bliss. And so it's kind of, devotion is at the beginning, and devotion is at the end, and devotion is all the way through. It runs through everything. So what the living entity has to realize is that it is not God, meaning it is not the controller of everything, it is not that upon which everything is dependent. Madhva stresses that the self has to realize that it is the agent, so it is responsible for its actions, unlike what Shankara says. He says, ultimately, the self is not an agent and not an enjoyer of its action. Madhva says, no, the self is an agent, but it's not the ultimate agent. And it has to realize that it will only attain liberation by grace. It will only obtain freedom from bondage through grace. And that's the grace of God. Secondarily, the grace of Vayu, who of course is the sort of in a sense the guru of the whole world, of the whole universe, And he's the one that guides us. He's the one that offers all our actions to God. And so we have to assist him in doing that and offer ourself our actions to God. And it's by his grace that we can obtain liberation. But Madhva also says it is also the grace of the other gods. And so again, we get his whole hierarchical interest. He says that God is at the top of the hierarchy, but it is not that when you are devoted to God that you ignore the hierarchy. You have to know your place within the hierarchy. And so you have to understand that you're dependent upon the grace of all the other gods that are, all the beings that are above you as well. To come to the final point, if you go to the very bottom of this chart here, it says you have, just to guide you through this a little bit, and it says there's sentient beings which are here, and then he says there's those touched by sorrow, which is basically, as he says, there's one being that is untouched by sorrow, which is Sri, which is Lakshmi. She's sort of a separate category. But then those touched by sorrow is all the living entities. And he says there's two types. There are those who have obtained freedom from suffering, those who are liberated, which can be of all those types below. And he says those whose condition is suffering, those who are suffering at the moment, which would be all of us. And then he says, then he has this further distinction. He says those whose condition is suffering are of two types, those fit for liberation, and those unfit for liberation. And this is an idea that's very peculiar to Madhva, in that he has a sense of predestination. He says not everyone is fit for liberation. And there's some, and you can see it, there's some that are not fit for liberation, but they're tamoyogya, they're fit for tamas, for darkness. And he says there's those that who remain perpetually in samsara, the nitya samsarins. And they will never attain liberation. So it's only a certain class of beings who will obtain liberation, and those other ones, and then those fit for darkness, you have again two types which later tradition clarifies. But he basically says there will be, you have the notion of in Hindu cosmology, you have sort of the middle realm, which is where we live, and then you have the realms above, which is heaven, and the realms below, which are hell. And you know, they have a concept of hell, but you obtain hell and you're sort of there for a while, and you're sort of punished for your bad acts, and then you come back to the middle realm. Madhva actually has a concept of an eternal hell, which is at the very bottom of the cosmos, sort of in his cosmology. And he says that's where certain living beings will go. And his authority for that is he attaches a lot of importance to a phrase in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, to those who are demonic, I cast them perpetually into hell. And he says they'll just be reborn again and again and again in hellish existence. And so he says, only certain beings will obtain liberation. Only certain beings are fit to obtain liberation. Now, there's some that will just perpetually remain in samsara. They'll just, climb up and down the universe. And there's some that will end up in hell and will perpetually remain in hell and in a state of suffering. And that's just the way they are. And of course, you might say, well, that's not a very kind God and so on. But Madhva says, well, God didn't create the living beings. They're just co-eternal with him. And so it's not God's responsibility. And he's not involved with it. It's just the nature of these beings is that they seek suffering. That's his point. But of course, the big question is, well, if you're a follower of Madhva, how do you know which category you belong in? Am I fit for liberation? Am I not fit for liberation? And Madhva kind of says, well, you don't know. there's no way you know. But he says, best thing is that you act as if you're going to attain liberation, because if you are a mukta yogi, if you are one fit for liberation, you'll attain liberation. And if not, well, you didn't miss much. There's nothing. So it's kind of a version of Pascal's wager How do we know whether there's a God? And he just says, how do we know that we attain liberation? Well, you don't. So you just act as if you will. And if in the end it turns out that you don't, then too bad. Because of these several ideas, some scholars have said that Madhva is influenced by Christianity. He's, of course, in the south of India. where you have the St. Thomas Christians are there, and they've argued that his notion of Vayu kind of, some have said, resembles the Holy Spirit a bit too much, and his notion of predestination is surfaces in certain forms of Christianity as well. I actually don't think that's the case at all. I think for Madhva's insistence on the prominence of Vayu, it's basically straight coming from the Upanishads. The Upanishads repeatedly talk about the importance of prana. There's a number of passages that all commentators kind of gloss over, don't really deal with. The Taittiriya says that Vayu is the visible manifestation of Brahman. You have in the Isha Upanishad a verse that Madhva really likes that says, and into him, unto him, unto Brahman, the Matarishra, which is Vayu, offers or places all the actions. It's again a line of a verse that all commentators kind of have to struggle a bit with and twist it a little bit. And Madhva kind of said, well, you know, that's very easy. That's Vayu who offers all actions to God. And so there's a number of passages in the Upanishads that he highlights that other commentators don't really know what to do with. And so I think that comes from there. His idea of predestination, I don't know much about the form of Christianity that was there at the time, but I sort of have a feeling that didn't have a very strong sense of predestination.
His dualism is unique in Indian religions. Is it unique? And if it's unique, can we suspect that there is a Zoroastrian or dualist Iranian influence on his dualist understanding? Mm. Has someone written about that?
Not that I know. I would say Zoroastrian dualism is a very different form of dualism.
It's different, but an influence, you know. I don't say that it's a Zoroastrian...
No, because he sort of. I mean, he doesn't have this great being that's sort of opposed to God or sort of he doesn't have that at all, and so it's a very very Vedantic view, you know, sort of you have Brahman, you have the world, and so on. Like, the difference is that the world is not made out of Brahman, so it's different, and everything, you know, else has its sort of its own independent or sort of existence that is distinct but dependent on God. So it's a very different form of dualism, and I wouldn't really say the influence comes from there. One influence that there is from Nyaya and Vaisheshika. There are certain ideas he takes from Nyaya and Vaisheshika to develop his defense of difference, and one is the concept of Vishesha. You know, in Nyaya and Vaisheshika, there's the whole issue of you have an object and its attributes, and how are those related? And Nyaya and Vaisheshika says, well, they're through Vishesha, which is a characteristic difference. Madhva kind of uses that the term. You know, there's sort of a certain sense of dualism there, that you have an object and its attribute and they're not the same, and you know, they'll say they cannot be the same, because otherwise, you know, if you have a white pot and the whiteness and the pot are the same, then everything that is white will have to be a pot, and that's not the case, and so on, and it means you can't change the color of the pot, you can't paint it red or something. Madhva takes that idea and develops it in a fairly sophisticated way in order to come to his ultimate point of, you know, there's a strict difference, there's a dualism, a bheda, a distinction between everything. So I would say there's some influence from there. Mm-hmm. Some have argued that there's perhaps an influence of some Jain ideas. This is Jainism was very prominent, particularly on the west coast. There was a number of kingdoms there that were ruled by Jains, the kings were Jains, and so there was a big spread of Jainism in that area. And we know Madhva kind of really gets a go, have a go at Jainism as well as Shankara.
But I think Jainism is not predestination.
No. The predestination, I mean, that's very unique. I don't know any other school or any other thinker in the history of South Asia who has argued that but Madhva does. I mean, it's sort of, it's not the main point of his teaching, so it's kind of something that sort of comes later on, sort of after he's explained other stuff, but it is part of his idea. I mean, it's kind of, the Madhvas like to think of it as Shankara comes along, says everything is one, or there's only one being that exists, which is Brahman. Ramanuja comes along and says, yeah, but it's not quite that simple because there's difference as well, and the living beings in the world exist within God but are different, have their own identity. And then they say, so sort of a gradual progression, finally the Madhva says, no, it's two. So there's a difference, and they sort of see that as a progression and sort of culminates in Madhva, which is a nice picture. But of course, after Madhva, as we'll see later, they kind of go back more to Ramanuja than to Madhva in terms of their theological understanding. Anyway, that's Madhva for you. He's an interesting figure.